Now, one of the problems you find with evangelical churches, evangelicals, is that they are so anti-self-righteousness, they can be quite self-righteous about it. I am so indignant about self-righteous people that I have no time for judgmental people. I despise judgmental people. I can't believe they can be so judgmental. And I'm sure the irony is not lost on you. In fact, it is lost on some, though. You can read, if you go on some internet blogs and things, you can read about how nasty evangelicals are. They're very bad, nasty people, got no time for everyone. They're so judgmental and not very attractive and things like that. And I just read them with a mixture of laughter and frustration that people can't... They're saying how these people are these nasty things, using the same nasty descriptions of them. I was asked once to speak at another church. It was a church that did a community project, and they asked me to speak to the people who volunteered or were employed, because a lot of them weren't Christians. So I did a Christianity Explored course, similar to what you've done here, but a bit reduced. And there were two Christian ladies there, one from a Pentecostal church and one from a Church of England church. And they loved what I did. They said it was so encouraging. There were a group of non-Christians. They knew they weren't Christians. They were perplexed by what I said. And then there were a group from the church, and I did a survey at the end to see what people thought, and they said that what I presented was a very judgmental view of Christianity. In fact, I was very judgmental. The reason why is they said because I had said that everyone, bar Jesus, are sinners deserving judgment and need grace. But the good news is Jesus came and died for them. I'd said that. And they said, no, that's judgmental. And so I said, how do you think you get to heaven? They said, by being good like us, we all get to heaven. Bad people go to hell, not people like us. And so I was going, so that's the non-judgmental version. I mean, a few people did see the irony, but I was the judgmental one. So we see the deep irony in that, but there is a double one, isn't there? Because of our judgmentalism over judgmentalism, because of our self-righteousness over self-righteousness. How often have you caught yourself honestly thinking, I'm glad I'm not like that hypocritical self-righteous Pharisee? Or is it just me? Well, we've over the last month or so, been looking at Luke 15 and Jonah in the evenings, and both of them help us, don't they? Notice that in both Luke 15 and Jonah, they carry on after the tension in the story has been resolved. So Jonah, the tension is Jonah going to go to Nineveh or not? And when he does, what will Nineveh do? Will they respond to his message? How will they respond? What will God do? And that's all resolved by the end of chapter 3. But there's a fourth chapter, which makes us wonder, maybe the fourth chapter is the point of the whole book. There's a tension in this parable. Will the son go home? When he does, what will the father do? And that's resolved in verse 24. But that's only half the parable. The other half is about the son that we've forgotten about that was mentioned at the start. And I think there are two mistakes we can make in approaching this parable, and at least two mistakes I've made in the past. The first, the most common and the most easily to correct, is how the parable is generally told by people, which is about the first son. And it's about God taking back even the most reckless sinner, that we can't out-sin his grace. And of course that's true, and it is here in this parable. But it's not the point of the parable. The second mistake is when we get the point. You can think, how can you make a mistake when you've got the point? Well, you'll see. You've worked out the Bible maths thing I talked about the other week, that verses 1 and 2 come before verse 3 to verse 32, and that this is a pointed parable. It's aimed at the Pharisees. So the point is it's all about the older brothers. So the people that Jesus is speaking to are those who are offended by the fact that Jesus eats with reckless sinners. Correct so far. So those of you who were making the first mistake might now be thinking, wow, this Bible math stuff is brilliant. It's so straightforward when now you come to mention it, but I'm getting so much more from Luke 15. And the second group, making the second mistake, and it is a mistake, as you'll see in a moment, are thinking, I'm glad that we've got a minister who knows Bible maths. But I knew it all along. I knew all the time this was about the older brother. And then what we do is we then pound the older brother into the ground because he's so bad and nasty. Acknowledging that there's a bit of him in us as well. But they are bad, nasty older brothers that must be pounded. At least that's how I've used Luke 15. Because older brothers are very annoying. And these self-righteous people, we want to pound them. Actually, the application is at the older brother, that's true. But really this chapter is about God. So we can make ourselves feel very guilty, but really it's about God's attitude to both brothers and an initiative, an invite to change. The paragraph starts with a bit of scene setting in verses 25 to 27. The younger brother returns, and the father sets a party for him, and the older brother asks a servant what's happening. Now, it's worth reminding ourselves, I know some of you haven't been here for all of them, where we've got to. The first week, we just looked at the first couple of verses, really, and we set the context. In verses 1 and 2, Jesus is eating with scandalously sinful people, and that upsets the religious establishment. And it raises the question, who is Jesus for? And we recognize that we can be like that. And there's a danger of being morally upright and even a bit religious. We can both miss our own needs and block others out. In fact, we said that the religious upright, in some ways, can be further from the kingdom than people who are having very naughty, scandalous lives. The second week, we looked at the two lost and found parables, and we saw that God seeks out the lost and saves them, and that he puts enormous value on us when we were lost, not because we're found. He doesn't value people because they're found. He valued them when they were lost. That's why he gave up everything to find them. And then he celebrates in over-the-top proportions. We thought about the lost coin, didn't we? I guess the nearest thing that we would have would be a woman's engagement ring. And I guess a number of you have, I know at least one of you, has lost an engagement ring before and then found it to great relief. And of course you can relate to that, but then you don't ring up everyone in your street and from your church and from anything else you go to and say, let's have a finding the engagement ring party. That's just strange. But that's what God does, because he just is over the top about finding his lost people. And then the third week we thought about true repentance, coming to our senses and running home, being accepted by God as if nothing had ever happened. So that's the context, but now we get into the nub of it. Now Jesus is addressing the establishment, and an establishment that feels anger and mistrust at what Jesus is doing. And two things that are going to help us through this, or just two ways of summing it up, is first, the son's anger in verses 28 to 30, and second, the father's patience in verses 31 and 32. So first is the son's anger. In 28 to 30. Notice, even before we get into his anger, the context of his complaint is the father's pleading. Verse 28, the father goes out to him. So all through this chapter, the character that is meant to represent God takes the initiative. The shepherd looks for the one sheep. The woman looks for the coin. The father was looking out for his older son, waiting for him, and the father goes out to the older brother. God takes the initiative. But the going out, the invite, is what sets off the anger. So why is the older brother angry? In one word, it's resentment. And let's break it down into three parts to see this resentment, how it builds up. The first is in the start of verse 29. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders." He's been slaving for the father. Interesting detail, never disobeyed, to which we think, really? Never disobeyed? We'll leave that for now. But he thinks his work for his dad is slaving. Notice the contrast between him and his younger brother that we saw the other week. When the younger brother came to his senses, he's happy to be a slave. He knows he doesn't even deserve that. But this young man, who's been a son, is feeling like a slave. The work he does for his father is a chore. And I think we can relate to that. Do you feel that being a Christian is hard work? And by hard work, I don't mean, you know, you only get out what you put in. That anything that's worthwhile in life is hard work. I mean being resentful, because it's not like that. I mean slogging my guts out for God, and for what? What do I get out of it? I guess there's two kinds of people who do that at work, aren't there? You might work hard, and then you've been promoted and done well, and you sort of think, well, you know, I've been rewarded for it financially or in promotions. But there's other people, I guess you've probably experienced, everyone's experienced this at some point, working hard at work so that other people benefit. And then when you sort of go, why is everyone else getting these commissions or whatever it is while I'm doing all the hours? And the boss looks at you and goes, there's no I in team, or something like that. And you think this is really unfair, and you're resentful. And we can feel like that with God. And the second thing is jealousy. Second half of verse 29. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. not given a lamb to celebrate with, he gets the fattened calf. There's an answer in, we've got a book at home of things that children have said in school, and one of them is an answer to a GCSE RE paper, which is, who was not pleased to see the prodigal son? And the answer, a child put, the fattened calf. The older son feels badly treated. He feels that the younger son is being treated better, and he's jealous. And siblings are often like that, if you feel that one is being treated differently or better. The father celebrated at the return of his younger son, and the occasion is marked with extravagance. The fattened calf is killed, expensive jewellery is given, clothes are dispensed. And what does the older son get? Put that together with his feeling that his work is slavish, and you get this. Superiority, funnily enough. Verse 30. When this son of yours who squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf. In contrast to what he said earlier, I never disobeyed you. Look at what the younger brother has been up to. He's been squandering your wealth with prostitutes. Look what I've been up to, staying with you and never disobeying. And Christians can feel like that, can't we? We can feel superior over others because of our lifestyle, because of the service we give, because of our theology. But we're resentful because the resources are not going to those who make things happen. And that can be toxic in a church, the problem of being creedally right but heart in the wrong place. I've seen this in a number of churches. People know what's right. They perhaps have been very well taught, and so they labour to the right end, but resentful builds up at their work, at their hard work, especially if they feel it's not being noticed, and especially if they feel it's not being noticed by God. And the worst candidates for this has to be ministers. The person most likely to do that in this room is me. Ministers often feel that they've just been run into the ground, either by their church or by their own expectations. They're trying to do something for God, and they just say, God, where's the return? Where's the growth that I've put the hours in? Closely followed behind ministers are elders, because they do the same amount of work and not even paid. And then everyone else at church. They do stuff, they put the work in without any title or recognition. Sometimes it's just spiritual fatigue. We just go off the boil. There's another kind of resentment that comes when God does give growth, because the church changes with growth, and the kind of change depends on the kind of growth. So the music might change, there might be more or less liturgy, pews get moved around, new people step into leadership roles and are seen at the front or doing various things, and it just feels like a different place. And people just, you know, sadly people respond along the lines of, where's my fattened calf? Why is all this effort going into these new people? It's different. It's not the same. It's not like I remember it. Or to put it another way, what's in it for me? Now, obviously, there's a problem. We can see a bit of that, at least maybe you're not amazingly like it, but you will know a bit of that lies in our own hearts. And you might be thinking, okay, I've sort of got the point over these four sessions in Luke 15 now that we're a bit like the older brother. I now feel thoroughly depressed about it. What can we do? Well, the answer to that is in the next bit. It's found not in us, but it's in God. The second thing is the Father's patience in verses 31 to 32. These last couple of verses, we see what God is like. Now remember, of course, all the Bible is really about God. We like to make it about us, but it's really about God. But in seeing God, we see ourselves and how we should respond. The Father's patience exposes the older brother's problem. First, look at verse 31. My son, the father said, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. So the first thing is God enough? Do we love God for God, or do we love him for his potential to give us stuff? If the latter, then that is going to be how we're going to start to feel that we, when we do serve, that it's been slavish and why we get nothing back from God. And at that point, we need to rethink. God is enough and he is our reward. Isn't that the point? Maybe that's the point of this chapter or even the Bible, that God is enough for us and he is our reward, and our problems start when he isn't to us. And the other problem is he misses what's going on. The older brother misses the point of the magnitude of what's been happening concerning his younger brother. Look at verse 32 again. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. Maybe missing this, he's actually missing how the father feels about him. Of course, the younger brother takes up the attention because he's the awkward one. But the father felt like this about his older son all along. Maybe we missed the point about how God feels about us, and therefore the size of his love for the lost, who, to use Luke 15 language, are our younger brothers. Like a child jealous of a parent's giving more attention, but missing how the parent feels about both of the children. And the magnitude in verse 32 is that the son has moved from death to life. And that's what this chapter's been about, isn't it? Moving from death to life is worth celebrating. The older feels that he's missing out, but shouldn't he celebrate? And to obviously jump to what it's pointing towards, he isn't missing out, is he? He's going to be there at a future celebration. Well, back to this story. Shouldn't the older brother share the father's joy? Now, the good thing about doing something through stories, of course, is you can put yourself into the story. Maybe not necessarily a character, but one of the servants watching. Put yourself into the story. Imagine what's happened. The younger brother's run away. And what do we see? Well, when the younger brother returns, the father is looking out, waiting. So over the years this younger brother's been away, surely the older brother has seen, along with everyone else, his dad standing at the front of the house looking, hoping against hope that his son is going to come back. Surely the father talked about it with his older son, with the servants. If only he'd come back. You know, do you think one day we'll see him again? How could the older brother not have seen this coming? He can't be surprised at his dad's actions. He might be surprised that his brother came home and this whole thing was theoretical, but now he's back. So notice what the father doesn't say. He could have said, but he doesn't say, "Pull yourself together, you self-absorbed, selfish brat." He doesn't say that. I confess that's occasionally my pastoral technique at times, but the father does not say that any more than he says to the younger brother, "Where have you been?" when he turns up. Or, "Welcome back. I'm so pleased. We missed you so much. Welcome back. But things are different around here now." But notice at the end of verse 28, he goes out to the older brother, and then these patient answers here in verses 31 and 32. He shows the same patience with the older brother as the younger brother. On the face of it, these two brothers look so different, don't they? But really, they're the same. They're both lost. They just have a different kind of lost. As I said at the start, there are two common mistakes with Luke 15. First, to make it all about the younger brother, God takes back the sinners. That's okay as far as it goes. And the relevance for us, if we take that line, would be, phewy, God takes us back. And that's okay, because it's true. It's there in this parable. It's true. And some need to hear that. But we need to say a bit more, don't we? And the second mistake is to notice verses 1 and 2 are there, realize that the point is the Pharisee and the older brother, and be very pleased that we've got the point, and we're very sound, we're very observant, and then now we pound the older brother who've got it wrong. But Luke 15 is not primarily about us. It's about God first and foremost. Jesus came to seek and save the lost, but there are two kinds of lost. Often, we approach this as if God can transform the prostitute and maybe at a push with a miraculous work of the Spirit, even a banker, but not the morally upright. The Sunday school teacher, they have no chance. The elder, forget it. Luke 15 warns that the churchy person may be on very dangerous ground, and they're not realized on this dangerous ground. Then in some ways it is harder to work with the scandalously lost, but no one is beyond grace. Evangelicals, often, they love to say nobody's beyond grace, and by that they mean the scandalous, and they don't always mean it. But often they make it sound like the moral have no chance. But either kind of lost, God is patient with. And this is a problem for many of us, because we now have a self-righteous intolerance to self-righteousness. We can put up with anyone except for them. I mentioned a while ago, didn't I, that you knew this already, that I'd worked in what they call UPAs, urban priority areas, since I've been ordained, until I came here. And what I found is, working with some of these colourful characters in places like Peckham and Tranmere, I love to work with. The first funeral I did, the next of kin was a well-known local armed bank robber who told me I should have children, it calms you down, and then said, "You probably are a bit more balanced than me anyway, aren't you?" And it was great working with people like that. But the religious people did my head in. Completely. And you might be thinking, well, that's because you worked in the Church of England. And it's true, there is a Church of England way of doing it, where you say, well, you completely ruin that service, you put the nunc dimittis before the Te Deum. And if I don't know what that means either. But, you know, you've messed up the religious bit. But there's a kind of an evangelical way of doing it, where people turn up and they say, well, I'm looking for this kind of confessional, blah, 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 sort of church. And the closer they are to what I believe, the more I think my heart sinks they're going to be a headache. The more they like me, basically. But either way, there's a way back. And of course, we can see bits of this in ourselves, in both of these characters. And in fact, the problem comes if we can't see either. But where do we go from here? Well, we've just finished now a series in Luke 15. There are 32 verses. We've covered lots of ground, and no doubt there's lots more that can be said. In fact, I didn't read this in preparing for this, but there is a book by Tim Keller I read a couple of years ago, all about just this one chapter. And it's as I remember, it's very challenging, wherever you happen to be at. But what do we do now? Well, we've seen who Jesus is addressing and the issues he is tackling. How we can be prone to write people off or to be superior. How God values us, even especially when we're lost. There are two kinds of lost. We've looked at what repentance looks like and how God is patient with both kinds of lost. And both kinds need to come back to him. But what now? Well, I think there needs to be a shift between what we believe and what we do and feel. We believe something over here, but we do and feel something over there. And sadly, often we adjust what we believe to accommodate what we feel or what we do. We need to flip that and work the other way. We know this. We need to get it into us and feel it and do it as well. Jesus came for all sorts, and we need to feel his compassion and proactively seek the lost. And that means being willing to rub up close to the unwashed in more ways than one. Acknowledge there's a bit of older brother in us that makes that hard to do. And we may see that acutely in others and get cross with them. And there's an irony in that, because Jesus came for them too. We need to be patient with ourselves and with them. And of course, we get cross with them. It exposes which brother we really are. I know I'm the older brother, and I'm particularly an older brother with older brothers. And as I said with Jonah, it ends openly. The story has no proper ending. It could have ended in verse 24, it could have ended in Jonah 3, but it carries on and then doesn't end properly. It could have ended perfectly well, the tension's resolved, but then it doubles. And in verse 32, it ends with no ending. The tension is now unresolved. Does the older brother follow the father back in, or does he stay outside in a huff? And that's the point Jesus is making. Will you finish the story? Which are you going to be? Remember, the parable is in verses 1 and 2. It seems right that a sermon on this and a sermon series ends hanging too. We're just saying, well, you finish it. How are you going to finish it? He left the story hanging because we end it. We choose how it ends. The invite is there for us. Do we follow him in and accept his patient offer to reach the younger brothers, or do we stay outside in a huff? Let's pray together. My son, the father said, you are always with me and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. Oh God, we thank you that you seek and save the lost. We thank you that you seeked and saved us, whether we were religious and self-righteous or whether we were debaucherous and scandalous or anything in between. That you save us in helplessness and lostness. Please help us to realize our emptiness before you. Please help us to recognize our self-righteousness before you. And give us a heart for those who are lost, whatever kind of lost that they are. And equip us to reach them. And help us to be like you and be patient with them. Amen.